Welcome to On the Fly, a production of Talking Point Radio. I'm Mark Downey. This week I landed one of Montana's legendary fishermen and raconteurs cruising through the Bay Area on his way home from promoting a book that will change the way anyone who thought they knew him remembers Richard Brodigan. Jubilee Hitchhiker is the name of the book. Brodigan and his friends call the author Gats. William Gats Yortzberg is a novelist and screenwriter, 8 novels and over a dozen screenplays. You'd be most likely to remember him by his film Angel Heart, starring Mickey Rourke and Robert De Niro, based on his novel Falling Angel. He also wrote the story and screenplay that led to Ridley Scott's Legend. It's not often that a writer breaks sharply from a successful career in fiction to write something as ambitious and painstaking as a literary biography. And Jubilee Hitchhiker, an 850-page, 4-pound doorstopper that took almost 20 years to research and write, is nothing short of ambitious. I was tempted to strike up a conversation with Gats about the writer's life, being one myself. But since writers' lives are short, brutal, and boring, and Gats and I both knew Richard Brodigan during very difficult times in his life, it was, as you will hear, impossible to get off the topic. Let's start with a really simple question. Richard's been gone now for 20 years or more, and a lot of people sort of know about him on the periphery. They remember him as a sort of hip, poetic writer in many genres. But just to bring the audience up to date, even the old-timers, who is Richard Brodigan?
Well, Richard Brodigan now is remembered mainly for having become a kind of iconic literary symbol of the 1960s, the Summer of Love, the whole hippie, if you want to call it, movement, which is something that he totally disparaged. He himself would never have considered himself a hippie. He didn't even like hippies. I think he would have been startled to realize that whatever remains of him in the popular memory is simply his status as a kind of a figura rather than his work. His work seems to have slipped away. And that seems totally ironic because the energy that built his fame, you know, is something that he himself wouldn't really have welcomed. He was much happier when he went to Japan, where the Japanese treated him like an important literary figure, and Nobel Prize winners wanted to have lunch with him. And, you know, he was not seen as some kind of pop phenomenon. He was seen rather as an important member of the literary community. And the work itself sustains. I mean, if you go back to any of Richard's books and read them, the qualities that made them memorable to begin with still exist. Yet, much like Scott Fitzgerald when he died in 1940, all of Fitzgerald's books were then out of print, and Fitzgerald was considered some kind of relic of the 20s, some kind of a leftover guy from the flapper era that he helped make famous. And so is now Richard, considered some sort of leftover iconic figure from those long-gone flower power days. And yet the work endures, and just as Scott Fitzgerald came back and is now one of the most famous authors in American literature, I really believe that that will happen to Richard as well.
Of course, whether we like it or not, he is and was a popular icon. I mean, I think many people remember the image of Richard Brodigan and the antics of Richard Brodigan and the friends and girlfriends of Richard Brodigan and the parties of Richard Brodigan as much as they remember, I mean, people who lived in the Bay Area in the 60s and up there where you live, because he spent a lot of time in Montana, remember Brodigan, the personality, as well as Brodigan, the writer, and Brodigan's literature.
Absolutely. And he was a totally colorful personality. But, you know, just like people probably remember that Hemingway was a boxer and a deep sea fisherman and a big game hunter, none of that stuff really has anything to do with Hemingway's work, except when he, of course, wrote about it. And so now that Hemingway's been dead 50 years or whatever, you know, the thing that remains is the quality of Hemingway's work. And so that's all I'm saying about Richard. Naturally, if Richard hadn't been such an eccentric personality, I wouldn't have had much of a book to write because he dominates the book.
So if you were a literature professor now at a major university and you were teaching modern American literature and you're moving now into the lecture or the series of lectures on Richard Brautigan, how would you talk about his work, his oeuvre, his literature? Tells us we should care that this guy ever existed and that we should read his work.
Well, one of the true tests of durability for most authors, especially writers of fiction, is that people look to these novels and stories and poems as a reflection of the times in which they were written. So now Richard's work was able to give us an image of America, of the period which he lived through, in an utterly unique and poetic way. That's what gives him his enduring qualities, in that you can see how America was, and you will be able to see that 200 years from now, because he gives you the picture and encloses it in metaphors that are so unique that they can only have been delivered by Brautigan. So, for example, trout fishing in America, there's a chapter about a place in San Francisco called the Cleveland Wrecking Company, and it really existed, where you could go and buy old roofing parts and old doors and things that were demolished from old houses. So Richard saw that, and he saw America's consumer society that was running wild and still is, and he envisioned a section of the Cleveland Wrecking Company where trout streams were sold by the foot and stacked up. And so this is a kind of metaphor that is abstract and yet hits the nail right on the head, poetically.
Exactly. So you took 20 years to write this book. That's a third of your professional career, really, when you think about it. You probably have 60 productive years like the rest of us. So you spent a third of your very productive career writing this one book. Why so much time, and why focused on one writer in a very large, actually, literary period, 20th century Western American literature, which has tons and tons of people like Stegner and you and Hoffman and Dylan and all kinds of writers in different genres? Why 20 years on this one guy?
Well, naturally, if I'd known at the start that it would take 20 years, I probably would have run, you know, howling into the woods and thrown my hands up in despair. Half of that time was spent on research, more than half. And during that period of time, it wasn't the only thing that I worked on. I wrote and published a novel called Nevermore, and I wrote another novella that's as yet to be published. I wrote three film scripts under contract. I wrote a cover story for Men's Journal. In other words, I was doing other things. It just that the project itself, it gained a life of its own, and it was always there, sort of like the little black cloud that hangs over Winnie the Pooh's head when he's in a foul mood. I mean, it just wouldn't go away. And one of my lifelong credos is that you don't start things that you don't finish. And so I knew I was going to have to finish it. And then as it got longer and longer and it took more and more time, I mean, I was still writing and making phone calls to people to double check facts 3 weeks before the book was physically available. So in a weird way, it seems like I had this leisurely stroll through 20 years of my life. And yet at the very last year or so, it was going hell bent for leather to the finish line, which only came 3 weeks before the book was lying there on my doorstep.
Well, let's talk a bit about the length of the book. A huge, huge tome. I mean, I'm billing you for my hernia operation just from carrying it around my house. It's
4 pounds.
4 pounds, I know. It's gigantic. But it is, I have to say, a very impressive work. I mean, it's coherent. It reads well. Wherever you open it up, you're in the middle of a really fascinating anecdote or an event, an episode, or an analysis that is really worth reading. I mean, it is a superb book, really. But why 800 pages did you and your publisher, you probably wrote, if you're like me, you probably wrote 1,000 and cut 300 or 200. But why so much on one person?
Well, again, it wasn't wholly deliberate. But the more I dug into Richard's life, the more material I unearthed. And there's tons of stuff that was left out, even in the writing process. And by the time I was finished, I'd probably had a manuscript of about 2,000 pages, of which I cut up more than 800 were cut out. And maybe I could have served myself well and cut a couple hundred more. But on the other hand, as it began to take this shape, I suddenly saw that the size of the book itself was one of its statements. And the statement being, since we discussed the fact that Richard is oddly forgotten 25 years or so after his death, by doing a book of this size, it's like saying, hey, pay attention to this man. He's worth a book as big as the ones that presidents get or as big as Elvis got. You know, this guy was an important figure in American culture, and I'm going to celebrate his importance by writing a big fat book.
Well, okay, 20 years focused on one guy. You talk to everyone that you could find that knew him, including me and others, and you knew him personally too, but after spending 20 years of talking to everyone who knew him, and people who knew him really well, like Don Carpenter and others, you must have had a different image of the Richard Brautigan that you knew, getting this massive rashomon on his life from all his friends and acquaintances. So my question would be, after poking into all the dark corners of Richard Brautigan's life and writing this biography, do you like him more or less than the guy you knew?
The Richard was far more complex than the guy I knew, and I didn't realize it then. I should have, perhaps, but he put his friends into compartments. And so, I mean, he had a whole range of acquaintances and friends that I knew nothing of, and he behaved differently with different friends. And so I was the guy that lived next door that had a kind of family and had a vegetable garden and chickens and pigs, and he called me Farmer Gats, and I could help him with his plumbing, and he'd come over and have coffee in the morning. And for example, he never talked to me about my own writing. He did give me a wonderful blurb for my novel, Falling Angel. But aside from that, he never had much to say. And yet, in researching the book, especially in talking to so many of the women in his life, the girlfriends who'd come to visit, I found out that Richard would tell them that he really loved my writing. And he would give them my books and say, here, read this. This one's a gem. And I had no idea that he felt that way. So, and now to circle back to whether I liked him, I mean, there were times when I, even as I knew him, when it would be 4 o'clock in the morning and Richard would be just dead drunk and I'd be pretty well halfway drunk myself, and I would be just praying internally for him to go home and get the hell out of my kitchen. And I probably hated him at that moment. But, you know, the next morning when he'd come over with his coffee cup and his hangover, everything would be forgiven. So in the same way, stuff I've learned about him, I mean, he was capable of acts of generosity that were just enormous. And at the same time, he could be petty and mean-spirited beyond belief. So the warts are gigantic, but then again, the sort of heart of gold lurking within was bigger than I thought also. So it's a complicated thing about, they say that biographers always end up despising their subjects, and I don't really feel that way about Richard. I know that having read, you know, almost everything he wrote, published and unpublished, I still have enormous respect for him as a writer.
You're listening to On the Fly. I'm Mark Dowie, and my guest today is William Gats Yortsberg, author of Jubilee Hitchhiker, The Life and Times of Richard Brautigan.
He wrote a poem once called Cannibal Carpenters, in which he kind of alluded to biographers as people who wanted to build a cage for you out of your own bones. You know, so all of his secrets would, so he would have not liked that at all.
That's Gats Yortsberg. Join me for the second part of the show when we'll discuss the challenges one writer faces profiling another. That's coming up next on the Fly with Mark Dowie. You clearly spoke to, interviewed, conversed with hundreds of people.
Almost 200, I think, yeah.
To put this life together, I mean, that's very impressive, 200 long interviews. Do any of those interviews stand out, either the person or what you heard from the person? What was your favorite interview, if you can recollect one?
Well, some people are just better at telling stories than others. And so often these people, of course, are writers. But I had a couple of interviews with writers that weren't so good at all. But the interviews with Don Carpenter stand out as being, because Don was a fabulous storyteller. He knew Richard from the 50s on and was probably his best friend and was with him, you know. Don was the last person Richard spoke to while he was alive. He made a phone call to Don probably minutes or within a half an hour of pulling the trigger. So that, you know, then also Price Dunn, one of Richard's oldest friends, was the model for Lee Mellon, the Confederate general from Big Sur. Now, he himself is not a writer, but he's a great raconteur, a Southerner. And so my interviews with him were, again, they were very much fun. And what I was looking for was anecdote. And I didn't want a yup and nope kind of answers to questions. I wanted as much anecdote as possible. And I was always pressing for that. And you know, it was amazing to me to go back. And when I would read the transcripts, I would see myself sabotaging my own interview. I'd be going along and there'd be an answer to a question. And then I would like turn the topic in a completely opposite direction. And I wouldn't have realized I'd done that till I was looking at the transcript. And I say, my gosh, why didn't I go for the jugular on this one? But often I didn't. And then by then it might be too late, because the sad thing is so many of the people I interviewed are now dead. I'd hope they'd be around to read the book, but they're gone, so many of them. And, you know, Don is gone, Bob Creeley.
Speaking of being around to read the book, I'd be very curious to know what Richard would have thought had he not ended his life and this biography had come out while he was alive, and I got him on the phone and said, Richard, what do you think of your biography? Have you got a sense of what he would have thought of this book?
On a certain level, he would have hated it, because he was very secretive. And Don even remarked on this when I was interviewing him. He said, well, there's nothing he was so secretive, he would have done anything to prevent people from finding out these little things in his life. And now he can't do anything about it. And here you are, like prying up all the rocks and looking at all the little sow bugs running out from underneath and talking to everybody that, you know, so all of his secrets. So he would have not like that at all. In fact, he wrote a poem once called Cannibal Carpenters, in which he kind of alluded to biographers as people who wanted to build a cage for you out of your own bones. Yet on the other hand, I know that, because I remember when he was reading it, there was a two-volume biography, I think it was by a guy named Blotner, of William Faulkner, and Richard was a big Faulkner fan, and I think he really enjoyed. I know he talked to me about that Faulkner biography, and so it's not that he was opposed to biographies in general. I just think he was opposed to stuff being written about himself, just as he was very controlling over his image. And he didn't like anyone to take a snapshot of him. Very few snapshots of Richard exist. What exist are photographs taken by professional photographers. And he always had an official court photographer. And those were the pictures. And even most of those he would not allow in print if he didn't like the image. So Richard would have definitely, you know, he might have thought the writing was okay, but he would have been offended by the fact that I snooped, you know, that I talked to everybody, his high school classmates, for, you know, all that stuff that he wanted to leave behind forever. When he left Eugene, he never went back. He never saw his mother again. He never saw his sisters again. He left home at 21. When he died 28 years later, he had never seen any of these people again. He just turned his back on them. So here I am bringing them back into Richard's life. So probably he would have grumbled about all of that.
Let's talk a bit about the ending, which you begin the book with. Very, very powerful opening paragraph. I was not surprised when I got the call from Don Carpenter telling me that Richard had ended his life. Were you?
Well, I wasn't so much surprised, but I was halfway upset and offended, because Richard and I had been estranged for the last couple of years of his life, and I'd been out of the country working on a film, and he'd been out of the country a lot. And I detailed the reasons why we had this kind of breakup. But at the very last summer, you know, of his life, he was living in Bolinas, so I was back in Montana. And he called at me and patched things up, and he wanted to collaborate on a screenplay. So we started doing that on the phone. And, you know, we'd only had two or three conversations. And then in October, I happened to be in New York. I was working on a film with a director who's based in Paris. And he came over, you know, New York was sort of a halfway point for us to meet. And it turned out by some coincidence that just about everybody in the Montana gang was in New York. I mean, Chatham was having a show. McGuane was having a book published by Vintage Contemporaries. Jim Harrison was there for other reasons. Well, anyway, we were all there. And so it was kind of a phone chain. News of Richard's suicide just went from hotel room to hotel room. And my first reaction is, he can't be dead. You know, we're working on a screenplay, for crying out loud. And, you know, so it was totally self-serving on my part. But then there was a kind of bleakness that set in, because when someone is dead, that's it. You know, they're dead. And so I think we all felt a kind of sense of letdown. And as my pal John Fryer, who owns a bookstore and stationery store in Livingston, said, and he took photographs of Richard, he said, well, Richard finally figured out a way to hurt all his friends at once.
Here's a question that I'm sure all writers have about this book, about Richard Brautigan, and about you and why you wrote it. The difference between writing a novel, a screenplay, and a biography. You've written all three, some really good novels, a lot of screenplays, and some of which have been produced, and this one huge biography. They're very different processes. Can you talk a bit about how they affect your life as a writer and how the processes differ?
Well, to begin with, the biography, as it turns out, is a hell of a lot more work. You can't make anything up. I mean, it all has to be based not only on research, but when you hear certain stories, you have to have more than one source before you can actually believe that it's true. So there's this tremendous amount of work. Yet on the other hand, being that I'm a storyteller and that's how I see myself, I wanted this book to have a narrative arc that would carry the reader through. And so I tried to use as much of what I know instinctively as a storyteller about beginnings, middles, and ends, about dramatic tension and foreshadowing. And so that first chapter was a deliberate choice on my part because it sets in motion the idea that this book is a tragedy. You know right from the first sentence that the person that's being described in this book committed suicide. So that foreshadows everything. That provides a kind of, it imbues the book with a sense of tragedy and then gives me this narrative arc. In a way, it's sort of like it gives it an element of the detective story. Like, why did this guy do it? Wasn't he world famous? Why would he do such a thing? And so then the book carries through till the final chapter, where it, you know, it joins up. I mean, I think the last sentence in the biography is Richard placing the gun barrel in his mouth. So it had a structure for me that I based that structure on stuff I knew from writing narrative, other narratives.
So what do we learn, Gatz, Yortzberg, what do we learn from all of this story about the dark side of the writing life?
Well, you know, it depends on how dark the personality is. I mean, Flaubert talked about like how you should live like a bourgeois so you can write like a titan. Well, that's the last thing that Richard did. I mean, Richard lived like someone utterly out of control, you know, and did exactly what he wanted, and whether it was shooting off guns in his kitchen of his house or drinking 2 quarts of whiskey a day or womanizing to the point where he had Quell by the gallon jug in his bathroom to combat all of the various vermin that were infecting him. He just was a bigger than life character. I don't think that Richard's life is necessarily indicative of all artists' lives. I mean, I think there are artists who are more extravagant and more self-destructive than there are people like me who are ever much more cautious and, you know, hope to live to be 100 and don't see life as things that happens in spurts and moments, but rather as a kind of ongoing stream. As I said, death walked by his side in every tiny poem. I mean, that was his theme. You know, just as Hemingway wrote about honor and how you face peril and your own death and what kind of behavior you have. Well, that was Richard's theme also. And, you know, you can't compare lives, but the thing that sets Richard apart from, say, myself and even many of my other writer friends is that Richard truly became world famous. You know, he became as famous as a rock star for a brief period. So there's a kind of cautionary tale in looking at his life. It's like, you know, it's very bad never to have realized your dreams, but maybe it's even worse to actually have them all come true, because Richard in some ways couldn't handle it. He expected it from the time he was in high school. He told his friends in high school without any basis that he would be a world famous writer. And he was diagnosed as a schizophrenic in the state mental hospital at age 20, precisely for saying stuff like that. They thought he was nuts. And you know what? They were wrong, because he was a world famous writer eventually.
So you and I were part of the same scene, the Richard Brautigan scene, the Western United States, the literary scene. And we both knew him. And we both knew a lot of people that he knew, male and female. And so he's a figure in our lives, and he's a figure in the lives of the culture that we have existed in for the last 50 years. And I'm curious to know what the rest of the world thinks of Richard Brautigan now. Even if you hadn't done this book and drawn a lot of people's attention to him, is there still a Richard Brautigan following, fan club, literary appreciation group in the world, elsewhere in the world? Are there other civilizations, societies, or cultures that still revere Richard Brautigan and his work?
He's enormously popular still in France. In the UK, actually, the UK has a magazine called Beat Scene, in which, you know, everything is devoted to celebrating the authors of, you know, are known internationally as the Beat Generation. And Richard has been called the last of the Beats. And this, too, is a designation he would have spurned, even though people like Gary Snyder and Phil Whalen and Michael McClure are among his closest friends. He was a loner. He was not a joiner, and he did not see himself as part of the Beat Generation. But he's revered by this Beat Scene magazine and a whole range of followers in England and France, in Germany, very popular in Germany, and the Scandinavian countries. As for the rest of Europe, I'm not so sure, but Japan, I think he's still considered an extremely important 20th century author in Japan.
Well, you've certainly paid a worthy tribute to this man's work, and I love it, so I'm glad you did it. I'm wondering whether you have a sense of how the complete works of Richard Brautigan and even the classics are going to hold up in a century. There'll be another century of literature available in the world. This will become more and more a part of a period, a genre, a sort of temporary outburst in world literature, hip lit, call it whatever you want. Will it hold up in a century from now the way Faulkner has, the way Hemingway has, and other people that you've mentioned, the way Stegner has?
Well, I think it will, but Hemingway made this observation once. He said, while you're alive, you're judged by the sum of all your work. But after you're dead, only the good stuff counts. So there's some of Richard's books that are lighter than others, but they all share a kind of sense of the human condition, a kind of bleak despair. You know, we're all doomed to die. And Richard knew that. Death walked by his side in every, you know, silly poem that he scribbled off on a bar napkin. And so I think that certainly Trout Fishing, In Watermelon Sugar, I think these books have qualities that are permanent. And I quote Ken Kesey in the first chapter of this biography, in which he said that, you know, 500 years from now, they'll still be reading Brautigan. So that's a very generous assessment. 500 years, you know, like, I'm not even sure there'll be a world, livable world left in 500 years. But, you know, hopefully whatever mutant creatures are left around, if they still read, they'll be reading Richard.
So I assume, circling back to how we started this whole conversation, I'm assuming that you now believe that the most compelling, relevant, and important thing here is not the life of Richard Brautigan, it's the work of Richard Brautigan. Is that so?
In terms of Richard's legacy, yes. But from my point of view, since I just wrote a biography of Richard, which dwells largely on the logistics of his life, I mean, I talk about his work, but it's not that much of a critical book. I just make the assumption that he's an important writer and one with permanence in him and was worthy of this book. So I'm thinking about my book, and, you know, and I'd love Richard's work to endure forever, and I love Richard's work, but I'm Yortzberg. And so I look at, for example, when we look back at the 18th century, who do we remember more? I mean, we only remember Samuel Johnson because of Boswell. So in a kind of egotistical way, I hope that if Richard endures, that this biography endures, that this is a great biography worth reading on its own, whether or not we care about Richard at all in the future, that it's interesting on its own light without having to stand on his shoulders, just as you can read Boswell now, and it's a fabulous read, whether or not anyone reads any plays or poems or books, criticism by Samuel Johnson.
You've been listening to William Gatz Yortzberg in conversation with your host on the Fly, Mark Dowie. This segment of the show was edited and mastered by Stephanie Welch and recorded by Allegra Bandy.